On Thursday, November 8th, Massachusetts Peace Action and Encuentra 5 sponsored an event called The Elections and the Unpeople. It was a left perspective and analyst on the recent elections with featured speakers Noam Chomsky, Vijay Farshad, and Samantha Christensen. The structure of the program was that each speaker first gave a brief talk about their impressions of the elections. They then had a panel discussion amongst themselves about their comments, with questions added from the moderator. Then finally, it was open to questions from the audience. The event took place at the Old South Church in Boston and was recorded by your radio host, Chuck Rosina, for WMBR and Radio for All. Professor Chomsky was the first to speak.
I've spoken here any number of times at all kind of meetings, and I don't know about you, but I always find it kind of intimidating to be up here as if I should say something profound and extremely meaningful and way beyond me. But I'll talk for a couple minutes about what we were asked to talk about, the election. There are two good things about Tuesday, in my opinion. One is that the worst didn't happen, and the second is, came close, and the second is that it's over. And that means, for one thing, we can stop getting annoying phone calls, but more significantly, it means that activists can go back to what they should always be doing. As far as the election's concerned, the right attitude towards it, in my opinion, was to take about 5 minutes to think about what to do and then forget about it and go back to what has to be done. And what has to be done is to, you all know, is to work to change the conditions that allow extravaganzas like this to go on. And insofar as there are elections, make them meaningful, but meanwhile, change the society so that it really does work for the people, as we just heard. That's a big task. Now, there are a couple of interesting observations about the election. Some have been discussed, some not much. There were, I think, some good things. So personally, at least, I'm glad that Elizabeth Warren got in. I think that could be very helpful. There were also some unpleasant things. One of them, which didn't get a lot of publicity, is a referendum in Michigan, which was voted down overwhelmingly. It was a referendum guaranteeing the right of collective bargaining, that is, guaranteeing the right of workers to organize. That's the fact that that was defeated, and defeated substantially, is kind of an illustration of the work people like us have to do. It's a reflection of the extreme effectiveness of the huge propaganda campaign against working people that's been going on for a long time, but has really peaked substantially in the last couple of years. It's basically bipartisan. And it's reached the working class substantially, which is a very dangerous phenomenon. And that goes to something else that is barely discussed. And one of the most important things about the election, I think, is what didn't happen. What didn't happen is that almost half the population didn't even bother to vote. Now, if you look at the correlation between voting and income, you find it's extremely close. So what that means is that roughly the lower half of the income level didn't bother to vote. Those people have been carefully studied. Their attitudes are social democratic. If they were to vote overwhelmingly, they would vote Democratic by probably a factor of maybe 3-1 or something like that. And their votes, if they did affect policy, would change the country significantly. So the question is why they didn't vote. Well, a lot of possible reasons. One reason is just that the contemporary version of the old poll tax, which goes back to the Constitution, was enough to inhibit lots of people without resources from voting. You read about all the efforts that have been made by the Republican Party to prevent voting for quite good reasons when they know who they're going to vote for. So that surely had some kind of an effect. But my guess is that a bigger effect came from something that people intuitively understand, even if they don't know the data. The topics have been quite well studied in academic political science, and with a lot of work on public attitudes and public policy and the relation between them. And it turns out that about 70% of the population, the lower 70% on the income level, have no influence at all on policy. So it doesn't matter what they think. So they're effectively disenfranchised. And if you move up the income wealth level, you get more influence on policy. And when you get to the very top, the 1% in the imagery of the Occupy movement, more accurately, the 1/10 of 1%, where the real concentration of wealth is, they essentially get what they want. Even if people haven't read the academic studies, I think they know in their bones. And I presume that that's a major reason why almost half the population doesn't even try to participate, knowing that it's not going to make any difference what they think anyway. Well, that's another major task that has to be addressed. They're not wrong, incidentally, but we have to change the conditions in which they're right, and that's no small task. Something else that must have been obvious to everyone who bothered to look at the newspapers Wednesday morning was the maps. Had to strike everyone who looked at them that this is the Civil War. The red states are the South, the blue states are the North. The West wasn't around then, so we can cut that out. I mean, it was around, it just hadn't been conquered yet. In fact, it had just been conquered from Mexico, but it was not really integrated into the society yet. And that's pretty significant. One of the reasons, the U.S. is somewhat different from other industrial democracies in a number of ways. One way is it has never barely had class-based parties. It's had sectional parties, and that starts right after the Civil War. The slogan was, you vote where you shoot, you know. So people who were on one side voted one way, that was Democratic in those days. The people on the other side voted the other way, it was Republican. Now, it's not 100%. So in the North, the Catholic working class voted Democratic, but they didn't have much influence on the Democratic Party, in fact, practically none. They were kind of Tammany-type situations, ethnic local policies run by Irish politicians or something else who cared for their immediate interests, but the parties, in fact, both the parties, quite quickly fell into the hands of wealthy manufacturers and financial interests. They were somewhat different, and incidentally, they remain somewhat. The names have changed, but the division remains. So in the 1960s, with the civil rights legislation and Nixon's Southern strategy, so-called, the names changed. So the old Democratic Party became Republican Party, and the old Republican Party was substantially renamed Democratic Party. Again, it's never been exact. It wasn't then. It's not now. One other thing that happened since the 1960s, and you all know it, is that there's been an enormous rise of racism, extreme racism, and it shows up in the a demography of the voting. So it was, as you know, I'm sure it was to a very substantial extent, it was a white versus non-white vote. You can tell it in the statistics. not 100%, but substantially, and in fact much more than before, which is not a good thing for the country. Furthermore, you see it in other ways. If you look closely at polling results, at public attitudes, there's a lot of evidence that the racism is deep, and it's based on fear. Fear which is sometimes articulated that they're taking our country away from us. They being, you know who, we, the whites, especially the white Protestants, we're losing our country. We're becoming a minority. And people know that, and they're terrified. It shows up, the hatred of Obama goes way beyond any rational explanation. It's amazing when you look at it. So half of Republicans think that he intends to impose Islamic Sharia law not on the United States, but on the entire world. About 25% of Republicans think he might be Antichrist. 40% of Americans, all Americans, think he wasn't born in the United States. Now that means practically all Republicans think that, yeah. Well, you know, these are divides that raise very serious problems. It's interesting to study how it happened. I'll just end by saying that throughout modern history, it's severely undermined the possibility to develop an organized militant working class, a couple of exceptions, like CIO organizing in the 30s, Knights of Labor in the late 19th century. But it's pretty standard, and it's a very bad now. Unless there is an organized militant labor movement, it's very unlikely that the goals of changing the society will be achieved. And that's a major task in itself.
Vijay Prashad is a well-known journalist and author of many books. He's currently writing The Poorer Nations, A History of the Global South, which will be published in 2013. He was next to address those assembled at the Old South Church.
Thank you, Soren, for inviting me. Unlike Noam, who uses a virtual teleprompter, I brought some pieces of paper. Scattered are the lunatics, like rats, scurrying across the floor in panic when the lights are turned up. For 40 years, they have assumed that the cultural world of the United States is to their advantage. Hatred of the outsider and of women distinguished their social view. Theirs is the rhetoric of freedom and liberty, papering over very lightly a politics of suffocation. The main word was no. No to this, no to that. No to a woman's right to dignity, no to the unfurling of the full personality of the outsider. No to the social wage, public transport, public schools, public health care, public welfare, and of course, no to getting high. This election revealed that beneath the votes for this or that political party lies a social landscape that seeks real freedom. The votes for gay marriage and for medical and recreational marijuana tell us that the days of the preacher's aura in the polling booth are soon to be over. The lunatics are in disarray. To quote, of all people, Alec Baldwin, it is a bad thing for a political party when you ask, did the rape guy lose? And the answer is, which one? Buntings of blue have emerged in the southern districts of Texas, leaking into the bastion of republicanism. By 2034, the United States will be a majority-minority country. There it is. The lunatics are unprepared for this transformation. They are addicted to racism and misogyny. There is no 12-step program for their recovery. They are too far gone, undone by their habits of fear, hatred, and arrogance. The fraternity runs the campus, society as Animal House. What of the winners? Certainly they are not social cretins. They do not flinch when talking of sex and women or of race and the outsider. They do not look at every woman and assume that she is a vessel for their contentment, or at every outsider and think that they are either to be deported or jailed. That is their temperamental advantage. They win by default, by the habits of a two-party system. It used to be said that the Democrats are the lesser evil. If the political world can be seen as a kaleidoscope with three bits of glass inside, one of those bits that reflects in the mirror confirms the Democrats' progressive advantage. That is the glass that says on it, women and outsiders. But the two other pieces of glass on finance and war are interchangeable between the two parties. There is no lesser evil here. Only, as the Black Agenda Report's Glenn Ford put it, the more effective evil. Because the party of lunacy makes gestures that turn off the majority of the country, it is harder for them to actually disembowel the entitlement programs, to drain the tank of Social Security and Medicare, to break the back of union power. If the Democrats do it, liberalism sniffs and moans, but then acknowledges that this is perhaps inevitable, that the times require responsibility. The shadow of Bill Clinton's evisceration of liberalism hangs heavy on the Obama presidency. Grand bargains, balanced budget amendments, deep cuts to the tune of $2.50 for every dollar in spending. This is the economics of finance capital, and it says nothing to the global job situation. The parties of Wall Street, both of them, say nothing to the millions of disposable people who will never be able to find meaningful employment in this dispensation. A society dominated by finance capital suffers from acute joblessness. Money is made through mathematical manipulation, not through trade in goods and services between real living people, all of whom have irritating things like desires and wants, encumbrances to the world of finance. No cuts to the military, no let up on war. A few hours after the election, drones struck in Yemen near Sana'a, killing at least three people. A finger in the eye of the United Nations, whose bureaucrats have slowly begun another investigation into drone attacks. The habits of belligerence are so ingrained that at the third presidential debate, neither candidate inhaled reality and exhaled the truth. Obama said that Romney was speaking as if he was in the 1980s, with Russia as the main threat. The fact is that both seem to be stuck in that fateful decade, shrouded by the fog of American supremacy. More ships, with bayonets or not, more troops, more bombings. Even when they say they want more diplomacy, what they mean is the strangulation of countries, embargoes of Cuba and Iran, harsh economic warfare that does not build the confidence between nations. China and Iran are set to change their leaders, China now, Iran next year. But neither candidate reached out to the new governments, eager for a new relationship. Theirs was the framework of pro-Israel, anti-Iran, pro-machismo, anti-negotiation, pro-1980s, anti-21st century. So where does this leave us? Some confidence in the fact that the social landscape favors the politics of the future. Great tasks manifest ahead to move the landscape away from the parties of war and Wall Street. Base-building organizations across the country are alive to the possibility of a more systematic assertion in the political domain. What fails us consistently is a much shriveled historical imagination. We fear the lunatics and run for shelter, inconsistent with our own self-awareness that their roof is rickety. The tasks of an expanded political imagination are already available. There are the little things, the passage of the Employee Free Choice Act, which would build up the enclaves of organized labor, an increase in the minimum wage, an allowance for bankruptcy judges to write down mortgage debt so you can end finally the foreclosure epidemic. Then the big things, revitalization of the public sphere and an increase in public goods, transport, schools, housing, not only for their usefulness, but because these would allow a serialized, privatized population to get a sniff of social solidarity, to give us a cultural preview of a socialist communitarian world. If we relied upon each other and saw each other more, we'd build trust in our capacity to shape this world. That was the lesson of the Occupy movement, and it endures. But not this, not social democracy, not that, planetary humility. The IMF forecasts that by 2016, China will be the world's most powerful economy. That date is within reach. But the US political class has denied its importance to the population. When empires collapse, they prefer to go to war rather than to allow a peaceful transition. World War II heralded the collapse of the British Raj, just as the Napoleonic Wars led to the usurpation of Holland's preeminent position. Empires stubbornly try to hold on, unwilling to read the tea leaves. The finance capitalists are the canaries, hastening from the old center of empire to the new, fleeing Amsterdam for London in the 18th century, and then from London to New York in the last one, and now from New York draining investment capital into the Pacific Rim and other emergent centers. In the 1920s, the old war dog Winston Churchill moaned, "I would rather see finance less proud and industry more content." Too late. Money had already fled, and the deindustrialization of Britain left Manchester and Sheffield as heritage towns and not the powerhouses they once were. The anatomy of imperial decline of old contains the anatomy of the decline of the American empire and of the American dream. Detroit, Michigan, Gary, Indiana, Solvay, New York, shadows of what they once were, ghosts of industrial might. Belligerent talk backed up by the menace of aerial bombardment threatens a planet that does not seem to have the appetite for another superpower. The Chinese are content with multipolarity since their entire foreign policy seems to be driven by the Treaty of Westphalia. You do your thing, we'll do ours. This is a historical opening for the planet, with regionalism allowing for the emergence of new kinds of solutions, whether in Latin America with their own trading agreements and their own political platforms, or in Southwest Asia with India, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan creating a new Southern Silk Road. The Southern Silk Road is an important development in the creation of regionalism, linking South Asia to Central Asia and West Asia to China. No longer will these regions go through the US and European-dominated routes to conduct their trade. As a result of the growth of regionalism, US primacy and its unipolar approach is being set aside. The deepening links with Iran are a testament to the lack of US domination in the region and of its political failure to isolate Iran. Americanism is a false utopia. Regionalism is today's reality. It's too bad we're so left out of understanding what's happening in our own world. Thank you very much.
Samantha Christensen is an instructor of history at Northeastern University and longtime activist. She took a slightly different take on voting and activism.
Great. Thanks. I have to say, this is very much my first time speaking from a pulpit, so this is kind of a personal moment for me, I think. I think I'm going to take a slightly different track from my friends today, and part of the reason for this is when it comes to the international policy, I think that fellow worker Chomsky and Dr. Prashad are more qualified than I am to make these commentaries. But I'm really here as a historian of social movements, but more importantly, I'm here as an activist. And I'm here asking really the same question that you're all asking, which is, where do we go from here, right? So this election is over. We've had this new election season, and we need to think about how we're going to move forward, because even though it sort of feels like something has happened, I think deep down, in a way, we all kind of know maybe not all that much did happen and change. And rather than this being a night about talking about a new course of action, it's more a night about talking about getting back to work. So these elections, I feel like, come along and they're like weird punctuations in this sort of larger conversation that we've all been having and can and should be having. And they're loud punctuations and they're disruptive punctuations. So every 4 years, and even 2 years to some extent, but I think it really exists most dramatically at the presidential level, for upwards of a year, at least 6 or 9 months, the election sort of dominates our conversation and we stop talking about a lot of things. We start talking about national politics and we start talking about policy and positions, but more insidiously, there's an implication that comes in every few years that implies that the solution to the world's problems is going to be solved by who's in government. And not only is this obviously not the way that most of us discuss politics when, it's at least most of us that consider ourselves to be radical to some extent, it's not the way that we talk about politics in non-election season. And it's more so it sort of builds this tacit acceptance and this even tacit empowerment of the state as the solution. So every time we sort of stop and make the national elections the sort of forefront and the totality of our conversation during the election season, we build the state. We build the state stronger. And conversely, by erasing and making invisible all of this sort of non-state level action that's taking place and that has been taking place in the years preceding and even during the elections, we disempower, at the very least, we ignore the potential power of non-state level action. And this is, you know, one of the themes of tonight. That we haven't talked about much is this idea of the unpeople. And I feel like this is a layer of unpeopling, right? It's the silences of things that are expendable when it comes down to political discussion, replaced by this reification that the state is the most powerful and important thing that we can imagine. And in fact, I sort of envision this much like a ritual that's like the opposite of carnival, right? So much of the social purpose of the carnival ritual is that there's this sort of bubbling over that carnival fulfills, right? So you have a somewhat oppressive society or you have oppressive systems in society, but here and there you are, or sort of annually, you have this moment in time where you can let the steam out so that the whole pot doesn't blow over, right? And I feel like the election cycle in the United States is almost the reverse of that. So we have this sort of like, okay, quiet approval and quiet acceptance of grassroots organizing, but every 4 years we're going to clamp down and remind you, just in case you forgot or just in case you get too excited, that really the state is the solution to the world's problems. And it's really just about who's in government, right? It's not about you folks out in the street. But the effect of this is that there's a shrinkage of the acceptable discourse that takes place during the election season. And a lot of it is guided by fear. And we all take part in this. So the sense is that we don't want to empower the right? So we have the lesser of two evils. We don't want to, this isn't the time to be too critical, right? I've heard myself saying things like this. And really, we all sort of swallow and go along with lines of argument that that we would never, ever say if it were not an election season. So we go through this and we set aside important conversations and we're silent and we hold our tongue because we don't want the worst of the two evils to be in power. So yes, we could be critical, but we'll wait for that. And we line up, literally and metaphorically, and we vote. And I think for the record that we should vote. I'm not an abstenter, and I think that there's a delusion of election season that sets in that maybe this will be the election we will actually move this to some sort of radical discussion or even progressive discussion. But I think my biggest argument for voting is that the elections in the United States have consequences for the entire population of the planet. And we are really, as the tiny portion of the world's population that has any degree of voice in these elections, we do have a certain sort of global social obligation to show up and fill out the bubble. And it's really the least that we can do. And I think I'm stealing this line actually from Noam Chomsky, that voting is really the least we can do. And so we all know deep down that very little of the change that we need is going to happen by voting. And the change that we need, to sort of state it baldly, is going to happen through mass mobilization, it's going to happen through building communities, and it's going to happen through direct action. It's not going to happen through electoral politics. After we have mass mobilization, building of communities, and direct action, then perhaps electoral politics might change. So the answer to the question of where do we go from here in the post-election is the answer that we know already, and it's the same answer that would have been in place no matter who won the election. The answer is that we get back to work. We get back to building a movement that's rooted in radical politics and not political talking points, a movement that's rooted in international solidarity and action and not national interests. And the reason that I say that is that one of the biggest casualties of the election sort of shrinkage of discourse is the global dimension of the mobilizations for change. And Dr. Prashad brought this up already, that as everyone saw during the presidential debate on foreign policy, this was really just a conversation on the nuances of how and when to invade other countries. And really this sort of fairy tale myth of the United States as a purveyor of democracy across the world. And there was even this completely open acknowledgement that the underlying motivation for anything is really still just the US interests. There was literally no discussion of ways that the candidates might work to address issues of social justice globally. The absurdity that a presidential candidate would talk about global social justice, I think, belies the fact that this is so removed from the conversation, we don't even expect to hear it anymore. There was nothing about how they would work to support the right to water, to clean food, the right to move freely from one place to another, the right to control the resources in one's communities, the right to medication that is currently being blocked by US corporate patents. And we could go on, issues that the United States is intimately involved in, issues that the United States government is intimately involved in, but that aren't considered acceptable points of political discourse in a presidential election. And the point is that even in the one conversation of the election season that's supposed to be about the international role of the United States, all we were really hearing about was national interest and none of the consequences. And I think the same was the case with the economy. So everything was about the American middle class this year, right? And getting American consumers to go out and spend more, and how to get American consumers jobs so they can have more, so they can spend more, so they can buy more. And American consumption was made into a measure of national success. And in this sort of shrunk discussion, there's no conversation about what rabid consumerism means to the rest of the world. One time, I just want to hear in an election season a politician say, well, that maybe if we don't want to have sweatshops shirts, that we could just pay more for our shirts. And of course, we would never hear that, right? This isn't electoral level politics. This is grassroots politics. Well, these are the same issues. You know, and I use as a point of example on this issue of shirts. At the height of the election season in September and October, when we had international media covering every, you know, sneeze that each of these candidates made, there were two massive fires on the outskirts of Dhaka in Bangladesh. And these massive fires ravaged the slums where thousands and thousands of garment workers that producing clothing for American corporations lived. And there was a remarkable, by which I mean not remarkable at all, absence of the entire event in the news media and in the political campaigns. And this is a pretty major event. The reason that, not just because it's an area of my interest, the reason that it was striking to me that it wasn't covered was because it revealed a couple of sort of disturbing aspects. So the first thing that I think that the sort of invisibility of the fires in Bangladesh revealed was that there's a couple of unpeople invisibility functions taking place. First of all, these are poor garment workers in Bangladesh, right? Their inconsequentiality and their expendability was already established long ago, and we can measure that in the control of and measure of their working conditions. Second, there's no sexy revolution taking place in Bangladesh, right? Most people are scrambling around trying to make sure that they know where we're even talking about when you bring up Bangladesh. There's certainly no spring taking place. So there's no political capital whatsoever for a politician to talk about this. And I think this really gets at the core of what an election and what the sort of level of discourse gets at, is that it's not about the topic, it's not about the content, it's about the popularity, right? It's about what people know, and it's about what's sexy. So I think where we go from here is that, yes, we can look at the silences that were in the media, we can look at the silences that were in the campaign, but I would encourage everyone, and I include myself in this, to also look at our own silences, right? So how did we participate in this invisibility? How did we change our rhetoric during the elections? How did we lose focus? How did we stop working? I think that in the spirit of looking towards the positive and toward the active, a really great example for us to look at right now is building off the groundwork of the pre-election season that Occupy was lying, or that Occupy laid, and looking at the Hurricane Sandy relief effort that's really being facilitated by the Occupy movement. And the reason that this is so critical for us to see and acknowledge and point out and think about is that this is really the convergence, or this is a really prime example of solidarity model working, right? So you have local direct action. You have people on the ground and local asking, not telling, asking, what do you need? And then communicating that message to a larger, wider audience. And then the larger, wider audience is able to communicate and to send back the resources that fulfill and provide the answer or the supplies in response to this question of what do you need. We can commit ourselves here and now to getting back to work, building a radical mass movement that is based on the principles of what we have in common, that is based on asking each other what we need, and not being told what we need, and looking at common grievances, but also common desires. What are we working for together? And commit ourselves to learn and to listen and to remember the invisibilities that we forgot about during the elections campaign, and to remember the silences that we've gotten out of the habit, or the silences that we've gotten into the habit of in. So the elections are done. It's this punctuation, this interruption is over, and it's time for us to get back to work, right? It's time for us to organize. And I'll leave it at that.